From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news for this day in Maine, May 11th, 2017. And on this day, the Maine House rejects a bill that would have made Narcan users pay for the service. And we'll visit a Canadian power plant close to Maine ports, fisheries, and farming, and look at some of the arguments on renewing its license. Those stories ahead in just a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by the Law Offices of Joe Bornstein, dedicated to serving injured and disabled Mainers from Kittery to Caribou. JoeBornstein.com. And by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Masters of Policy Planning and Management, preparing students to be a force for positive change in their communities.
First tonight, the Maine House has rejected a bill supported by Governor Paul LePage that would allow cities and towns to bill people for the cost of using Narcan and similar drugs to revive them during a drug overdose. The preliminary vote was 81-67. Mal Leary has details.
Local police and other first responders would be allowed to bill overdose patients for the cost of administering naloxone under the legislation that still faces further action in the House and Senate. Republican Representative Trey Stewart of Presque Isle is chief sponsor of the measure. He told his colleagues before the vote that it's a way to provide relief to more than those experiencing a life-saving emergency.
We need to be looking at creative ways to figure out how to not break the backs of these municipal budgets who are already overburdened.
Stewart, who works as a firefighter when he's not serving in the legislature, says a single dose of the drug can cost $100, and it often takes more than one shot to counter an overdose. Governor LePage has recommended that only the first shot be free. But Representative Patricia Hymanson, a Democrat from York and a retired doctor, said the bill would prove to be a burden to towns in the long run.
Trying to figure out a way to get this bill to somebody who may not have survived, who may not be reachable, and how many attempts do you give, and what kind of penalty do you ponder if you haven't received the reimbursement, would be very difficult.
Hymanson said there's no law preventing local cities and towns from trying to recoup the cost of providing naloxone, but she's skeptical that doing so will generate much in the way of revenue. The proposal drew strong opposition at its public hearing from the medical community, who argued the bill is punitive and would get in the way of efforts to address the state's opioid crisis. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
Meanwhile, the Centers for Disease Control estimates that about 34,000 Americans contracted hepatitis C in 2015. Maine has also seen a big increase in reported infections. Patty White reports on what's behind the trend.
Cases of acute hepatitis C nearly tripled from 2010 to 2015, according to the CDC. Maine's rate also tripled within that time frame, and state epidemiologist Dr. Siri Bennett says it's likely connected to another public health issue.
At the moment, it appears that current transmission is being driven by the injection drug users.
The most commonly reported risk factor for hepatitis C is injection drug use. Just as the opioid crisis is showing no signs of slowing down, Kenny Miller of the Health Equity Alliance says the rate of hepatitis C infections continue unabated.
And I really think we're only beginning to see the burden of this issue as far as hepatitis C is concerned, mostly because it occurs on something of a time lag.
Acute hepatitis C can be asymptomatic, but 75 to 85% of cases develop into chronic hepatitis C, which is still infectious and can cause cirrhosis and liver cancer. Miller says people who are actively injecting drugs should get tested for the virus every 6 months. He says they should also use syringe exchange programs, though there are only about a half a dozen in the state.
There should be a syringe exchange in every county to prevent the further growth of this hidden silent epidemic.
Miller says the Health Equity Alliance may seek emergency legislation to fund syringe exchange programs. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
A Naples man detained last month on immigration charges was deported to his native Guatemala today. Fred Bever has more.
Otto Morales Caballeros had been living in Maine for some 2 decades, working most recently at a Saco lobster packing plant. but he was undocumented, and immigration officials say he was subject to a deportation order dating from 2010 and had also confessed to falsifying a Social Security number. Morales Caballeros was picked up a month ago near the home in Naples, where he lived with Sandra Scribner Merlim, who is his spouse and a native Mainer. Merlim says since his arrest, her husband has been moved to various detention facilities around the country and now has been deported to Guatemala City. Merlim says she hopes to visit him there soon and to help him find a legal way back to Maine. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
The Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission is considering whether a 34-year-old nuclear power plant just across the border from Maine should be relicensed for another 5 years. Pointe Le Preux may not be as well known to Mainers as Seabrook Station in New Hampshire, with a significant urban population nearby. But with Maine ports, fisheries, and farming all within a 50-mile radius of Le Preux, there is a lot riding on the operation of the plant, which won't be decommissioned for another 25 years. Jennifer Mitchell took a tour of the plant and has the first of two reports.
At the end of a breezy peninsula jutting 6 miles into the Bay of Fundy rises a gray concrete tower and a complex of industrial buildings. It's the Pointe Le Preux Nuclear Generating Station. It's an odd bedfellow for the surrounding coastal marshes and grasslands, which serve as an important stop for migrating birds.
Hi, are you Paul?
I am.
Visiting a nuclear plant is a safety-intensive experience unlike any other. An initial checkpoint and security screening gets you onto the grounds. Inside, there's another security check, and then communications chief Paul Doucette hands me some forms to fill out, which must include a contact address.
And
do you need my personal one or the business?
Your personal one.
Personal one.
And I'll tell you why. We will send you some information about your visit.
All right. That sounds intriguing.
More on that in just a second. There are a few more procedural hoops, and then we're joined by Tony Munn, who is responsible for the facility and for me. I can't be out of his line of sight at any point. Munn gives me a second badge along with a little purple device.
You keep it in your upper torso on the outside, so you can put it on your jacket for now, and then we'll switch it when you...
Sorry, wondering what that is?
Yes, I am. What is this?
It's a TLD. It measures your gamma beta dose.
Or how much radiation I've encountered. That's the information that Doucette referred to earlier. In the coming days, I'll get a letter telling me that number, but Munn says he's confident the radiation dose will be a flat zero. Next, I'm given some blocky, unstylish shoes to wear, some safety glasses, a hard hat, and the tour begins.
Hi, I'm Al Phillips. The post-job brief is a meeting to review the work that was performed and to identify lessons learned.
Some nuclear basics now. Le Preux works by generating heat through the fission of uranium rather than the burning of coal, gas, or another fuel. That heat is used to boil water to produce steam, which then flows to the turbine room.
You see, we have a high-pressure turbine, 3 low-pressure turbines, and the main generator.
Le Preux Vice President Nuclear Brett Plummer explains that the turbines power the generator, which makes the electricity. The plant, he says, has only just come back online after 29 days of downtime for maintenance.
So we're constantly improving, making modifications. We actually took this high-pressure turbine casing off, and we looked at the turbine blading and the spindle on that HP turbine last outage to make sure we didn't have any cracking. Everything was in good shape, which it was.
But the turbines, the steam, and the generator are not what scare people.
It's the waste. If you can find a way to solve nuclear waste so that it's not going to be harmful for generations to come, maybe we can have a discussion.
About 30 miles away, Hugh Akagi has shown up at a Nuclear Safety Commission hearing in St. John to argue against Pointe Le Preux's license renewal on behalf of the Passamaquoddy Nation. Dozens of industry executives, regulators, and almost 100 registered speakers are also weighing in. Akagi says he finds the entire process frustrating. The tribe has members living on both sides of the border, but Canada does not recognize the Passamaquoddy as an official First Nations group. That means, he says, the entire nation, which straddles the border, has little leverage in the proceedings, even though the Pleasant Point Reservation in Maine is well within the 50-mile zone of concern should there be a radiation release. Akagi says he feels like the process stacks the deck in favor of industry.
To promote the facility, they need all morning, but for us to defend the land, we get 10 minutes.
all 95 interveners are given 10 minutes to present their views to the commission. The majority who favor relicensing the plant range from individuals to businesses who appreciate the savings on their power bills, although those rates have gone up 2% this year. Those speaking against include the Passamaquoddy, Maliseet, Mi'kmaq, and environmental groups like Greenpeace. Their issues range from the philosophical to cultural, environmental, and economic, with important fisheries just offshore. Back at Lepreau, we've reached that part of the plant which so many find scary, problematic, or at least mysterious, the reactor.
So you can see there's a zone 3 where we have whole body monitors. That yellow area is the barrier. And in order to get in that area, you need additional radiation protection devices.
So we're not actually going to go beyond that yellow barrier where the CANDU-6 pressurized heavy water reactor lives. It burns the isotope U-235 from natural uranium. Atoms from the U-235 are split, releasing energy and making heat. But only a tiny fraction of the uranium that goes into the reactor can be used. The rest goes out as waste for long-term storage. At the moment, it's being stored on-site. Brett Plummer says eventually it will need to be transported to another location, yet to be determined, and that will spark another round of hearings.
That's not the last radiation one. We have two more to go through.
Oh, we do?
We do.
Now, getting out of the plant is just as hard as getting in. All coats, hats, glasses, and my gear must be put inside a monitoring box and swept for particles of radiation.
Putting on my equipment?
Yeah.
And it won't hurt it, will it?
No. It just checks to see if anything's in it.
No contamination.
While the microphone takes a ride in the machine, we prepare to go through the next two levels of security, which includes a rather sci-fi full-body radiation scan.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Another checkpoint, another card swipe, another monitor, and we're back. Point Lepreau has had a few problems in recent years. One was aging infrastructure, which led to a $3.3 billion refurbishment that was completed in 2012. But since then, the plant has not been able to hit its performance targets, operating at just 78% capacity annually. So seeing the extreme vigilance required, the extensive and expensive maintenance needed, coupled with the possibility, however remote, of a truly catastrophic meltdown, why would anyone do this? Well, in part two, we'll look at some of those reasons and what a disaster would mean for Maine. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Jennifer Mitchell.
2, 1. For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Thursday, May 11th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.